some of our instructions in Scripture. And I'll just use these words from Paul in Colossians, and it's the chapter 3, verses 12 to 17. I stop right before the household codes where he tells me to submit. All right, so, put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassion, kindness, lowliness, meekness, and patience, forbearing one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which you indeed were called in the one body, and be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Teach and admonish one another in all wisdom, and sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. So that's one of the pieces that has been haunting me over these last few years. 7 years ago when I was still in Black Mountain, North Carolina, it's right outside of Asheville. That's where I was before moving to Chicago. Someone gave me a book. And it's by Marilyn Chandler McIntyre, and it's called Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies. So this is 7 years ago, and this is what she writes. Caring for language is a moral issue. Caring for one another is not entirely separable from caring for words. Words are entrusted to us as equipment for our life together, to help us survive, guide, and nourish one another. If language is to retain its power to do these things, to sustain our common life, we have to care for it, something like the way good farmers care for the life of the soil, knowing nothing worth eating can be grown in soil that's been used up, over-fertilized, or exposed to too many toxic chemicals. I don't know how you've been feeling, but over these past 2 years, I have felt like we are eating a whole lot of damaged verbal food by the ways that we have grown used to talking about and talking to each other. And the damaged verbal food culture in which we're all participating and even unintentionally helping to create is affecting our national life. I think it's starting to affect our collective soul. And I'm more and more convinced that something has to stop and change. And as a Christian pastor, I'm convinced that as citizens of God's household, it is actually a part of our call to work on actively dismantling the current culture of vitriol, the current culture of hate, the current culture of enemy that keeps dominating what we hear and how we respond. For if we who are considered Christ's living body do nothing and allow this national and political discourse to go on unabated, then as George Steiner put it, something of the lies and sadism will settle in the marrow of the language. Imperceptibly at first, like the poisons of radiation sifting silently into the bone, but the cancer will begin and the deep-set destruction. If we as people of faith, people who follow God in the way of Jesus, people who trust that creation was set into being by the speaking of a holy, creative, generative word, if we don't take responsibility for engaging in our world differently, for speaking differently, for listening to each other more generously, for turning off the cable news, whichever one you watch, as soon as people start to yell, for starting to read different perspectives, even when you disagree, if we don't start to change ourselves and the way that we engage with what's going on around us, then I think we start to fall short of living out of our baptisms. Because participating in cynical, demeaning, vitriolic discourse isn't what God calls us to do. And being fueled only by snarky, critical judgments of others, I don't believe that's how God hopes that we're going to live. But even as I speak these challenges, I know that changing our own engagement, because we tend to be complicit too, changing our own engagement in this cultural time is going to take conscious, intentional, sustained attention on our part. But we can't grow weary. Because I know even in the post the shooting that happened at the Republican baseball practice 2 weeks ago, You know, for a moment, we saw our political leaders coming together and speaking of unity. If it happens to one, it happens to all, and laughing together. And actually, we saw glimpses of genuine friendship, which who would have thought? We don't know those things anymore. My fear is that's just not going to last very long, because we've made it way too easy to just fall back into opponent and enemy language. And furthermore, that's what gets you reelected. If you always define yourself against the other side, But could you imagine what could happen if people like you and me committed to changing the ways we speak to or about each other, or even about those that we label as opponents, right? Lest that sound trite or naive, as I alluded to just a couple of minutes ago, we share a faith tradition that claims that God began the work of creation by speaking. It's built into us this understanding that the words we use have power. They have the power to shape both perception and reality. Who gets called a thug? Who gets called a loser? Who gets called a terrorist? Who gets called mentally ill? If you just look at the stories, the words we use have the power to heal and to wound. They have the power to define the arguments in very particular ways. And that's why I'm beginning to mourn the truth of the toxicity of our political and public discourse is having profound destructive effects on our culture. Tragically, I believe, we are becoming very proficient at othering each other, treating those we perceive as our opponents, or even those we just don't know, as somehow less than human and not worthy of respect. And I hear similar observations from other people, too. About 2 years ago or so, I had pre-election. I was a part of a small group who met with former Senator John Danforth, a good Episcopalian. It was actually at St. Christendom's there in Chicago, not too far from my church. And we are speaking about the subject of his most recent book. And in that book, he issues the challenge for people of faith. He issues the challenge that for people of faith to do nothing less than change the way that we do our politics. In particular, he challenged those of us in the room to ask both publicly and privately why compromise has become a dirty word. You hear that right now in the debate or lack of debate about health care reform. No one will compromise. When did that change? Danforth stated that compromise, especially in the area of politics, has always been a tool for getting things done. Because compromise means you have to listen to each other. You have to find a way to build consensus and work it out. In my Presbyterian tradition, we believe that God often speaks most clearly through the voices of other people, especially those with differing perspectives and life experiences. That's why we do everything by committee. We don't have bishops. We're very suspicious of putting too much power in the hands of one person or a small group of people. We do everything by committee because we do believe that that's how one way for us that God speaks most clearly. But, and honestly, sharing agreements and disagreements with each other is one way we discern holy wisdom. So this idea that our leaders, the ones that we are electing, are not allowed to change their minds, right? We call that flip-flopping. You're not even allowed to change your mind if you have new information or new experience or you hear someone's story and are shaped by that. They're not allowed to change their minds or to work across the aisle without being perceived as weak. I believe that's destructive, but we hear echoes of that mindset all the time. I believe we're called to challenge that mindset and to reclaim our ability to work together for change and justice. But before we can do that kind of consensus-building work, we first have to transform our speaking. We have to resist language that demonizes the other and uses language that honors the image of God in every single person, not just those with whose politics or religion we are most aligned. Because God isn't Christian. We are, right? A very brief illustration of what this could look like. A dear friend of mine is a Presbyterian minister in Baltimore, and he's one of the clergy co-leaders of a community organization called Build. And in the immediate aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray, my friend helped to organize a meeting without cameras between police commanders and the neighborhood leaders from their beats. And their sole agenda was to be honest and to listen to one another. These things are happening all the time. The problem is they never get microphones and no one knows it. The police commanders were asked, what has it been like for you to be a cop in this city for the last few months? You remember this was after all of the protests and riots. And the neighborhood leaders were asked, what has it been like for you to live in your neighborhood for the last few months? And there was candid, respectful, reflective conversation that flowed. And that work continues. Some pilot programs have started that involve putting together new training curriculum for new police recruits. And my friend told me that that initial conversation was one of the most powerful and transformative experiences of ministry he's ever had. I will tell you, in Chicago, there's also some stuff going on that never gets the press either. There are small groups of police officers and community leaders, as well as kids who are, you know, marked as those who are likely to shoot or be shot. There's a list. We have a list of about 2,000 young men primarily who are on that list, who we know that the majority of the violence is centered around them because they don't have jobs. They only make about $80 a day doing what they do on the street. That's not worth it to them. But these meetings are having, it's almost like Truth and Reconciliation Commissions coming out of South Africa. So they're sitting in a room and speaking honestly about their experiences together, but no one knows that. I mean, that's okay. No one knows it, and that's how it happens. But I just think it's so important when we live in this culture of polarization and demonization that we know that these other peacemaking activities are happening. For me, at least, it gives me a little bit of a breath of hope. But I think as people of faith, the words we use about each other and about ourselves matter. And we just can't keep tolerating words that demean another citizen based on their race or their religion or their ethnicity or their neighborhood or their economic status or their physical abilities. We can't sit by and abide language that barely conceals contempt for our fellow human beings. Not because we have to be politically correct, although I don't know when that became bad either, but because we're people of faith. It is who we are. Now, I fully realize that being intentional about the words we use is really just a first step. It barely scratches the surface of so many of these big other issues that we are facing. For me in Chicago, you know, some of those issues, as I've already alluded to, are the violence, poverty, segregation, and fiscal challenges. Man, Illinois politics is crazy. I've never seen any, and I'm from Texas, and we have our own share of crazy, but this is a whole new level. And others of you are going to have different challenges, of course, based on where you live. But I do think, though, being intentional about the way we speak and about even the news that we digest, though it's just a first step, it is a start. Because the way we talk about each other, or the way we talk about those we perceive as enemy or opponent, it shapes us. And it shapes our imaginations about what could be. I think our words shape the atmosphere of our culture. And I promise you, our words shape our children and our grandchildren, and they shape the future that they can imagine for ourselves. I even wonder, what if in Chicago, every time someone was shot, we talked about that person as one of our kids? You know, it's not really literally one of my, I live on the Gold Coast of Chicago. This happens in very particular neighborhoods. But what would happen if everyone in my church, 5,500 adults, started speaking about everyone who was shot as one of our kids? That changes the way we think about the entire thing, I think. So that's what about I've been musing about recently. I would love to know how that lands with you. And I would love to know if you ever step back and think about the ways in which you are or are not contributing to this ethos of destructive language. So, I mean, does this ring with you? What's feedback? Or just, I'll stop talking. Yeah.
Well, I think the internet has changed.
Huge.
Because you can say, like,